Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to this edition of Inside Scoop Live and Internet Voices Radio. This is one of many features presented to you by Reader Views. I'm your host, Gail Campbell. Hello, and thank you for tuning in. Today, I'm chatting with Patricia Marie Budd about her new novel, A New Dawn Rising. But before we dive into her book, I'd like to tell you a little bit about Patricia. She was born and grew up in Saskatchewan, Canada. In her early 20s, Patricia studied mime in Toronto, Canada, and then later in life renewed her interest in physical theater by studying with Philip Goyer in London, England in 96 and 97. For a couple of years, Patricia lived in Japan, where she taught English as a foreign language. Currently, her residence is in Fort McMurray, Alberta, Canada, where she's been teaching high school English since 1991. A little side note here, writing has obviously been a passion for Patricia. She's been writing since her early childhood, when in grade 5, she wrote a short story and performed it for her peers. The controversial quality of her writing was evident even then, as her teachers shut the play down. Much of Patricia's writing has been theatrical in nature, having a one-act play produced in the Rhubarb Festival special event in 1984. She has also participated in a number of playwriting labs under the tutelage of Sharon Pollock. In 98, she was a part of the Alberta Playwriting Committee. Patricia spent 3 years researching slave law and life in Georgia in the early 1800s, and hence her new novel, A New Dawn Rising, which in fact is Patricia's first novel. Patricia, welcome to the program.
Hi, Gail. Thank you.
What a fun tidbit about your childhood. So they shut you down, did they?
Indeed. Well, you see, I was in about grade, four or five, and I wrote a little play called The Fight. And I hadn't quite come to the understanding that our schoolyard banter does not work inside the classroom. So at the climax of the play, in the midst of the, you know, fake fight that I had happening, some of the kids started saying a few things. And, of course, they shut us down.
That's too funny. That is too funny.
I learned that, you know, there's language that is acceptable only at certain, you know, certain times and certain places.
That's true. The power of the word and the power of the age when you first begin, or when you begin using them, right?
Yes, ma'am.
That's too funny. Well, Patricia, as we're getting underway here, tell us a little bit about the storyline of your book, A New Dawn Rising.
Well, A New Dawn Rising is about a white man who is born into slavery and the struggle that he goes through to obtain his freedom. Most people, when I explain this to them, look at me quite shocked, like, a white man? Were there even white slaves? And I discovered, actually, after I wrote the book, that there were a lot more white slaves than I had even realized.
That's right. People forget about that, don't they?
Yeah, they forget about the poor Catholic Irish and how in the 1600s more Irishmen were sold into slavery than even the Africans.
Wow.
And if I had known this before, when I was writing my book, it would have made the scenario for my white slave much easier. I could have just made him the descendant of an Irish slave from Virginia. But I didn't know this, so I created a fictional scenario in which he was born into slavery through the transgressions of his parents.
Okay, gotcha.
And now he's at an age where he's trying to obtain his freedom. And, you know, the struggles that he goes through, the difficulty he has in forming relationships, the secrets that shroud, you know, from his past, and so on. And,
right,
of course, for me, the key behind this is that his desire is to be freed of the stigma of slavery and hold the truth of the Declaration of Independence to be self-evident, that all men were created equal.
That's
and,
right.
And, of course, the irony, the paradox behind the foundation of the American Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, was that this absolutely, truly noble and amazing declaration was not fulfilled because there were so many people who were enslaved.
That's right, because that document was written when?
Late 1700s.
Okay, and so slavery for blacks and whites was still very evident and prominent well into the 1800s, wasn't it?
Yes, and I actually chose a period, the early 1800s, because I didn't want a time close to the Civil War. There was a sense of hope, in essence, that, you know, with this war between the North and the South, for those who were enslaved, the war ending in the right way could lead to their freedom. But early in the 1800s, there was no sense of that. There was, you know, the conflict between the North and the South hadn't boiled to the point where they, you know, got into it.
Mm-hmm,
and so
mm-hmm.
anyone who was enslaved, unless they were successful at escaping, they were there for life, and they knew it.
Wow. Black and white.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Patricia, what inspired you to do the research and write a novel based on slavery in America, especially slavery of whites?
Well, first of all, I'm going to go back to when I was a little girl.
Right.
And my sister gave me the novel Roots by Alex Haley to read.
Uh-huh.
And I was probably in about grade 8 when she gave it to me. And once I started reading it, there was no television happening in my life. There was nothing. I was reading. You know, I'd come home from school, I'd pick up the book, my mom would make me shut it so I could come for supper, and then I'd go back and I'd read it, and then I'd go to bed. And once I finished the novel, I didn't even put it on the shelf. I went right back to the first page.
Wow.
And I started it all over again. And so that has been like a seed inside me. And then I've always been fascinated with the past, so I always fall into these fantasies where I'm living in the past. And but like I explained in another interview that I did, I have this cynical mind, and it doesn't allow me to rest in a pastoral fantasy for very long. I start thinking about, you know, what would it have really been like?
It's one thing to fantasize and romanticize, and then you start imagining what the reality would have been like. Is that it?
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. And then I started, you know, creating these. Then, of course, not having known that there was a really large white slave population out there, I started wondering what kind of circumstances would put me as a white person into this kind of an environment, because I wanted to empathize and understand what it would be like to have been a slave.
Right.
And so, you know, not being African American, I had to envision myself as who I am in that kind of circumstance. Ironically enough, I'm Irish.
Oh, no kidding.
So I've actually got a heritage of slavery that I was not even aware of.
Wow.
So, you know, maybe there's a sort of, you know, fate or karma or whatever.
Genetic curiosity?
Perhaps. But so I, you know, came to these ideas kept coming back to me, and I started creating this relationship between a master and a slave, because if you were, you know, white and the master didn't have a son, for example,
mm-hmm.
that child might even be taken in as a son.
As a future heir.
And this is the relationship that started to form with Uncle Jacob and John.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there I started going, whoa, wait a minute. I actually have something. And I really, you know, this isn't just a fantasy. This is an idea. This has potential. Something that I really believed in, to the point that I was prepared to research. And I started researching. I started going through the internet. I read about, you know, slavery. I read slave stories. I read about the history of slavery. I read the timeline of slavery of African Americans. I still hadn't learned about Irish slaves.
Mm-hmm.
But that's okay, because that really has no bearing on the novel. And I went and spent countless days, weeks, months, you know, over the course of time in the libraries. And the library at my school, my librarian was wonderful. She helped me, giving me lots of wonderful textbooks on American history. And all this amazing, amazing information came to me. And it enriched the ideas and the rough drafts that I had sketched out.
Oh, I can only imagine. Now, how did you wind up spending so much time in Georgia?
Well, once I decided that yes, I am writing about a slave issue, and I have, in fact, chosen an American backdrop, I did research on slave states. You know, I typed in slave states. I found out which of the states were the slave states and which were the free states and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And I started reading up on their history. And Georgia has this absolutely, it's the paradox of the founding of the colony was too beautiful, I guess, rather ironic term, for me to ignore. General James Oglethorpe founded the colony. And when he founded the colony, there were four things that he outlawed. He outlawed rum, he outlawed slavery, he outlawed Catholics, and he outlawed lawyers.
Oh, my goodness. Was there anybody that left?
Well, there were a lot of Protestants. He outlawed slavery. And I thought, my goodness, here is a state that was founded on a principle in which slavery was not allowed.
And yet, did slavery become the biggest part of Georgia at that time?
Slavery became a very integral aspect of the economy.
Mm-hmm.
The plantation owners petitioned against the anti-slave law, and they won. And so you've got, you know, your very staunch slave states.
So here came the lawyers and the slave owners and the and everybody else that was previously outlawed, huh?
Yeah, well, it took a long time. I think the lawyers were one of the last ones to be allowed in. Lawyers and Catholics. Rum, that was back right away. He couldn't even bat.
That's too funny. That's
yeah.
too funny.
Yeah. So, of course, that seemed to me to be a really nice seed for the whole paradox of slavery in America. And here, the colony founded with the principle that slavery was outlawed, and yet Georgia was a slave state.
Mm-hmm.
So there, that's how I chose Georgia, and then it was like, okay, where in Georgia? I want it close to the river.
Mm-hmm.
And Savannah, I learned about Savannah. I didn't even know Savannah, Georgia existed before I wrote the book.
Oh, really?
but I've fallen in love.
Savannah's charming, Georgia. Isn't it?
Oh, my goodness, it is so beautiful. I highly recommend a trip to Savannah for everybody. Tourism in Savannah should just go through the roof. It's just amazing. So I picked Savannah because of the fact that it's on this, you know, big mouth, the Savannah River.
Mm-hmm.
This Savannah, the city, is a port where ships come and go.
Mm-hmm.
And so that made it crucial to the slave trade. And there would then be an auction house in Savannah. And, of course, there was.
Where they were auctioning off slaves, white and black, men and women and children, weren't they?
Mm-hmm.
Well, Patricia, I know that there is a section of your book, a passage that you would like to share with us. Could I ask you to share that with us now?
Absolutely. I've picked a passage from the chapter called Enter the Enemy. It gives, it's a rather telling episode on the treatment of slaves.
Mm-hmm.
In this particular passage, one of the slave owners, his name is Junior.
Interesting
is
name.
Beating a child, a 10-year-old African slave.
He's beating the child, huh?
Yes.
Mm.
Junior was a wiry little man with blonde hair. He was 25, but barely looked a day over 15. Although Junior was handsome, there was a viciousness about him, all the Negroes had first-hand knowledge of his deep-seated propensity for violence. Junior did not just whip slaves. He enjoyed beating them. When John entered the barn, Junior had a bully whip in his hand. He was thrashing a small Negro boy who could not have been more than 10 years old. The metal-tipped whip had shredded the boy's back and splattered blood across the whole of the barn. The boy had cowered into a corner. Junior persisted with the beating, not only using the whip, but his riding boots as well. John was disgusted and outraged. He grabbed Junior's hand and held it back. Growling, John insisted, "This boy has been punished enough." Startled by the sudden stop, Junior cursed. He turned to see the giant John holding him back. Sheer hate filled his eyes. Puffing up like a wild turkey during mating season, Junior shouted, "Get your filthy hands off me!" John looked down at the younger man. "Stop beating that child." Junior struggled to free himself. "Do not tell me how to treat my niggers." "I said the boy has had enough." "I decide when my nigger has had enough," Junior shrieked. Panic started to fill his voice, and his eyes bulged. There was nothing he could do to free himself from John's hold. Junior's voice took on a high pitch. "Let me go!" It was then that John decided he would never do business with these people. In disgust, he let go of Junior and turned his back on him. Before he could leave, though, the elder Frank Crawford entered the barn. Mr. Crawford extended his hand in greeting. "You must be John Connolly. I am Frank Crawford. The help mentioned you were looking for me. Wanting to buy an ox, are you?" John looked the man in the eye. "Not no more, sir. I was just leaving." Mr. Crawford raised a brow to his son. He could feel the tension between John and Junior. Mr. Crawford noted his son's bloody hands and the Negro boy crouched and bleeding in the corner. "Hell, boy, what fool thing have you gone and done now?" Snatching the whip out of Junior's hand, Mr. Crawford stormed over to the injured child. The whip's metal tip tore more skin off of the boy's shoulder. The poor child howled in pain. "Well, Frank," Mr. Crawford demanded in a rough tone, "what foolhardy thing has this miserable little nigger gone and done?" Junior, facing his dad, recited, "This here lazy whelp failed to brush down my horse after I ran him. Then the uppity little nigger, instead of cleaning out tenant's stall, was found playing in the back with Wilfred." "Damnation, boy." Mr. Crawford had no qualms about cursing. "You know the value of that horse." The boy backed against the stable wall, crouching in fear. Mr. Crawford rewarded him with another lash of the whip. After the boy finished howling, Mr. Crawford bellowed, "Junior plans to race that horse in the fall derby. I swear to you, boy, if he loses, I will lynch you. Now get in there and clean that stall proper. And when you are done with that, you wash your dirty nigger blood off of my barn walls." "Yes, sir, Master Crawford," the still-weeping child barely managed to utter through gasps of pain. Frank Crawford turned his attention back to John. "Well, sir, you came here to buy an ox, leastwise that is what I was told, and now suddenly you no longer wish to do business with me?" Mr. Crawford's tone became menacing. "Is my stock not good enough for you, sir? Did you not see them in the pasture as you rode up?" John eyed the situation at hand. A boy cowering in the stall, Junior's bloody hands, and Mr. Crawford's scowl. John politely answered, "Your stock is in fine shape, sir. I just no longer wish to do business with y'all."
Wow, that's a pretty compelling segment. And in your research, Patricia, these stories are, they don't minimize the reality and the truth of the history at all, do they?
No, and I had no intention of that.
Right,
in
no.
In fact, quite a bit of the research made it into the book. One of the things that I discovered, one of the things I learned that was quite appalling was how one slave had run away, and after he had been captured, his master had branded the letter R on his face. to identify that this man was a runaway. A brand, like you would brand cattle, put onto a man's face.
Right. There's no question that that's a chapter in the history of this country that is just one that frankly brings about a lot of shame, and should bring about a lot of shame.
Indeed. Every country has that.
That is true.
Every country has that, even Canada. I mean, Canada has, you know, there's a lot of racism in Canada as well. Apartheid in South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
The government came to Canada to study our reservation system before going back to South Africa to establish apartheid.
Wow. There's
not a country on this planet
that doesn't have a shameful part in their history.
That is so true.
Wow.
And mankind has a shameful history.
You know, looking back over it all, there are so many eras, so many periods where, my Lord, you know, there are a lot of people these days, more and more of us, who really want to believe that our journey in life is about tapping into the true essence of ourselves, which is about being about love, gentleness, respect, regard for our neighbor, our sisters and brothers. And yet when you look back to the beginning of the time that history began being recorded, there are so many eras where we certainly were not demonstrating our better selves, were we?
No, and what's frightening is we can open our eyes to today and look at how we are still not bettering ourselves.
That's right. Well, all we have to do is to look around globally and see all the evidence of brutality, of aggression, of hostilities.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't even have to look very far. All we may have to do is to look out on our local highway for evidence of it.
Yes. It's unfortunate, but it's true. And just because I chose to write in the past mirrors the present in many, many ways. And it reflects humanity, what we have done, what we are doing.
Exactly.
And we need to learn from our past, and we need to change our present.
That's right. That's right. And just because there may be a moment ago that we might have behaved in a way that if we stop and catch our breaths and think about it, and think about what we hold dearest, we might decide that maybe that wasn't the better part of the self that we wanted to be. And to
mm-hmm.
and this next moment is the gift that's been given to us to do it differently.
That's right.
So
if one thing man has the advantage of, it's the ability to choose to change.
Right. That's right. That is so right. Well, Patricia, who are you targeting with this book besides probably everybody?
Who am I targeting?
Mm-hmm.
I'm targeting people who love historical fiction.
Okay.
People who love a good romance, because there is a good romance in here.
There is, isn't there?
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
There is also people who love the classical literature. My muse, and when I was writing this, I spent a substantial amount of time reading the Bronte sisters and Jane Austen
mm-hmm.
over and over to get a real sense of the early 1800 era. Now, it's not southern United States, but the social order that is important, that was very important to the southern lifestyle, really was very similar. And so I wanted, you know, that sense. So there is a real strong, well, my influences, Bronte sisters, Jane Austen. So people who like that style of literature, I think, would enjoy this as well. And anyone who likes a good read that will make you think.
Right. Good. Well, and with that in mind, what is the What ultimately is the message that you would like for readers to come away from your book with?
I think one very important aspect of this book is the element of forgiveness.
Mm.
And forgiveness on more than one level, not just because somebody has asked you for forgiveness, but also because if you do not forgive, within yourself is a bitterness and an anger and a hatred that acts like a cancer.
And it just infects everything you do from then on, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. It's like, how can you, an individual, a nation, a family, survive in a healthy manner when there is hatred?
Mm-hmm.
Forgiveness cleanses that. And so it's very important. It's a very important element. I mean, we have Uncle Jacob asking John for forgiveness and John refusing because he has been put through so much hell by this man.
Well, and of course, hanging on to that resentment and hatred and bitterness will hold him back. And once he can let go, once he can forgive, then he can be able to move forward.
That's right.
Patricia, we are just about out of time. And as we're wrapping things up here, tell the audience where they can find this wonderful new novel of yours.
Well, it is available online through iUniverse.
Okay.
Amazon.com or CA for those of you in Canada.
Okay.
And it's also easy to order from just about any bookstore out there.
Okay, and do you also have a website?
I do.
And?
www.patriciamariebud.ca.
Okay, Patricia, P-A-T-R-I-C-I-A, Marie, M-A-R-I-E, Bud, B-U-D-D.
Yes.
.ca.
.ca.
Fantastic. Well, Patricia,
and on my website, I have links to iUniverse, Amazon.ca, and BarnesandNoble.com.
Perfect. Patricia, I want to thank you so much for taking time to talk with me today.
Oh, well, thank you for having me on.
This is
a great honor.
Well, your book is compelling. What a compelling story. And, you know, I mean, there are so many aspects of it. The fact that it's historical, that it's set in an era that was highly romanticized, and the geographical setting itself, Savannah, Georgia, what a beautiful place. You're so right.
Mm-hmm.
Charming and sweeping and lush. And yet to deal with some of the harsher realities of history, not only about slavery, but an aspect about slavery that a lot of people tend to forget about, which is the fact that there was a large colony of white slaves.
And by the 1800s, the numbers of white slaves had decreased.
Okay.
In the 1600s, it was much, much greater.
Right, right.
By the 1800s, the majority of white slaves were in fact the descendants of African slaves, in which their mothers had been raped by the overseers and their masters.
Right.
Which is actually part of the stream in this book, because people no longer perceive of white people as slaves the way in which the Catholic Irish were.
Right, right. Well, I also want everyone to know that this internet radio segment is going to be posted on Patricia's page, the author's page, on InsideScoopLive.com. Reader views and Inside Scoop Live and the author's websites all will have links to this interview. So I want to encourage everyone out there to take a look and take a listen and consider this book for your own library and as a gift. Patricia, again, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
And audience, thank you for tuning in to this segment of Inside Scoop Live. I'm your host, Gail Campbell. Until the next time, bye.